You're listening to BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hi there, welcome to the Ringgit and Cent Show. I'm Julian Ng, and in the studio with me is none other than Mr. Koo Soo Chong. Today, we will continue with the third part of the series on the topic of how to be your own financial planner.
Well, before we go into that, let's take a review of what we talked about last week. The topic last week was about asset allocation, and as we know, that is the process of dividing our investments into the various asset classes to achieve an appropriate risk and return level, and hopefully realizing certain financial objectives over the long term. And we also talked about, Jules, about how asset allocation is fundamentally about retirement planning.
That's right. And we also identified three types of investors. Strong, you want to take us through it?
Well, aggressive investors are young investors who have a lot of time to plan for their retirement, and they can invest in risky assets like equities to the extent of 80 to 90%. And then in the middle, there are balanced investors who are like pre-retirement investors who have already accumulated some retirement funds throughout their career and want to protect their investments a little bit more, and therefore would have a higher proportion of bonds, you know, safe assets of between 40 to 50% of their portfolios. And then you've got the conservative guys, the retirees, whose main objectives are regular income and investment protection. Therefore, they might have up to 80 to 90% of bonds in the portfolio.
And of course, no matter what type of investor you are, it is recommended that you kind of rebalance your portfolio once a year. This is to take care of any investments that may go out of sync. For instance, your property or your equities or your risky investments may outperform, and then you want to bring the percentage of contribution to your portfolio back down to the original levels.
Okay, so asset allocation within the Malaysian context, what's all about?
For a normal wage earner in Malaysia, Chuang, it is hard not to talk about asset allocation without considering EPF and property investment. It's not only hard to talk about this, but it is also very possible that it will distort the asset allocation process because EPF and property investment are a very substantial part of one's assets. And when they are left out of the equation, you know, your asset allocation process may go awry. Now, many Malaysians love to buy their first property and live in it. And as we discussed before, property is considered a conservative asset returning between 3 to 4% per year over the long term. These are not my numbers. You can check the actual numbers by the National Property Information Centre, who runs the Malaysia House Price Index. So this 3 to 4% per annum is before rentals. You would add another, say, 3 to 4% a year if your property is rented out. But most people, of course, don't rent out their property if they live in it. But hang on, Raymond Chuang, last week we also talked about how when you take a loan for buying your property, this actually increases the risk and returns of that property. So this could also be part of an aggressive investment in the asset allocation consideration.
Okay, so if the ultimate aim of asset allocation is to spend retirement money, then how, you know, how does one then consume property?
Property is actually a very interesting asset. You know, you buy a property and you hold it for the next 30, 40 years. And at the end of that, you find that, hey, you know, you've actually accumulated quite a nice, decent nest egg for yourself. But you are living in it, so how can you actually monetize that part of your investments? So this is where you can make some very big life-changing decisions. For instance, you can actually move from the current property that you're living in to a smaller property. This is enabled by the fact that perhaps your children would have grown up and would have moved out, so you don't really need to actually live in the grand old big property that you have been living in the last few decades and move up to a smaller
property. Well, assuming you did have a grand old big property to start with, not in today's modern day definition anyway.
But you see the point, right? To move from a bigger house to a more modest
that
house,
that frees up some valuable investment capital, cash, which you can reinvest it, right?
So we are talking here about in the context of managing your property as part of your asset allocation process. And in Malaysia, the case is that most people have an overinvestment in the property, and they would have to consider how to consume that at the end of their retiring life or at the start of their retirement.
Along with your EPF savings, then you've got, as a percentage of your total net asset value, quite a large proportion. Now, if you, under your model, right, you take out the remainder, the disposable part, the what's left over at the end of the day, and you go invest it, and if you're an even category B, you know, let alone category A, and you're very, very aggressive or even a balanced investor, then you could conceivably put the remainder of your disposable funds in high risk investments, i.e. equities or equity equity alternatives, right?
Well, at that time, you would be retiring and you're considering a state of regular income. So you would want a lot of investment protection. So the cash that you raise from down trading your property from a bigger house to a more modest one, the cash that you raise has to be under the consideration of investment protection. So you would probably be investing in pretty conservative investments.
Yeah. But here's my question. The whole proposition behind property is the idea of leverage, right? Because you can buy a property on essentially 5%. I mean, according to the latest packages of the last 2 or 3 years, even 10%, right, if you are credit worthy. So, I mean, the whole idea is that you know, so say the property gurus, you buy 2 or 3, you live in one, you rent out the other, and you go along with the ride. You go along for the cycle, and it's paid off the last 10 years.
Okay, so if you are talking from the viewpoint of a very specialized property investor, then that may have been the right thing to do because this investor is in a position to actually do a lot of research, spend a lot of time looking into properties and try to buy the right property so that he could make some money out of it and most importantly, not lose any money out of it. But for a normal wage earner, I think one property is as far as he could go, and he could actually also simulate the kind of returns in the property sector by varying his stocks and bonds portfolio. He could simulate the kind of risk and return from the property sector. So, Chuang, I think the other portion that is very important in the asset allocation consideration in the Malaysian context is EPF. EPF is another substantial investment in any Malaysian portfolio. Almost a quarter of any Malaysian salary, if you're employed, goes into EPF, with half of each of the contribution coming from respectively the employer and employee. One of the rules of thumb of financial planning is over the long term, save 1/3 of your salary in order to have sufficient funds for your retirement. So EPF's 25% contribution from both employee and employer is already 2/3 of the recommended savings. EPF is also considered conservative because it returns between 4 and 5% per annum over the long term. So no matter what EPF tells you they have in their portfolio, the 4 to 5% returns per annum suggest that they give you a conservative and balanced stance. This is okay if you're a conservative or balanced investor, but if you are a more aggressive investor, it would be a problem because you have an aggressive objective. If such a person may actually be looking for riskier and higher returns, for example, to meet his retirement planning objective. So I guess the very simple message of this week's show is to consider your EPF and property values in your asset allocation percentages. This means that for an aggressive investor, his post-EPF and property asset allocation would likely be 100% into aggressive investments. And even for the balanced investor, he or she may find an overinvestment in conservative assets due to EPF and property.
Okay, I've seen how you've done this case study here, right? If you invest a grand a month, and this is the difference between a conservative return of about 5% a year versus an aggressive return of about 8% a year. After 35 years, a conservative investor has about 1.14 million ringgit in his coffers, right? Contrast this with the aggressive investor. At 8% a year, he gets 2.3 million ringgit in his coffers. Now, my question to you is, right, 8% return is obviously very, very good. You've got to take the risk and all the attendant worries that come along with it. Where do you go for 8% a year, year in, year out?
Okay, there are a few people who have looked into this analysis very closely. Burton Malkiel is one of them. He is the author of the very famous A Random Walk Down Wall Street, and he believes that market movements are actually random. He has provided some kind of returns, for instance, for large company stocks in the US, actually has an average return of about 10.4% a year from 1926 to 2005. So these are very long-term research. Long-term corporate bonds are about 6% in the United States, and US Treasury bills are about 3.7%. Another author, William Bernstein, he wrote The Intelligent Investor. Large US stocks essentially return about 3.5%, but if you want to take more risk, you go into smaller value stocks and emerging market stocks, which give return in the range of between 6 and 7%. So I think 8% is not too aggressive a number to suggest, especially when you're in Malaysia, you're in a position to understand more about non-US investments and therefore invest into more global emerging markets.
Okay, according to surveys, right, the BFM listenership is around about, you know, typically male, 25 to 45 professional urbanites, right? So typically these kind of people have typically already bought properties. They've already been working for, you know, between 10 and 20 years, and they would have already built up some kind of maturity and some kind of seniority in the organization. So assuming these guys have already bought the property, have already built up some kind of EPF, and they've already got some leftover income at the end of the month, right? Assuming they're Category B, i.e. balanced investors, or Category A, aggressive investors, then what's the strategy here?
Well, if you are planning for your retirement, or if you have worked for 20 years, the first thing to consider is that you want to determine how many years of employment you still have. If you're, let's say, 40 and you take a retirement age of 65, you have a good 25 years to continue investing, then a balanced approach would kind of be recommended, because you want to protect what you've already established and the remainder of that invest in some higher risk investments like equities.
Okay, let's take a break now, Jules, and when we come back, we talk about the concept of leaving an estate and how that features in the asset allocation process.
BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
Welcome back. Today, we are talking about asset allocation in the Malaysian context. Now, let's look into something that a lot of Malaysians, especially older ones, think about quite often. It is the issue of leaving an estate or leaving something in the will. Chuang, what do you think? Is this something that keeps you awake at night?
Definitely. Anybody who has achieved some kind of a maturity in life, or has, you know, filled out the nuclear family definition, you've got to think about it, right? You've got to think about setting aside something for your retirement. But beyond that, if there's
providing for your children,
over, you've got to think about, well, dying intestate, right? As opposed to dying intestate, which is leaving a will and, you know, nominating qualified executors that you know and trust as well, and who will more importantly live beyond you, because there's no point in, you know, nominating your dad to be your executor, because likelihood he's going to pass on sooner than you, right? And that's the next question, because if you hire an executor, or you appoint an executor, who a person who you went to university with, is he going to outlive you by at least 5 years so he can see your wishes through? Big question marks, right? So it's not as easy as it sounds.
Yeah, so those are very, very pressing questions, and it is definitely a prevalent practice among Malaysians to think about leaving an estate. Now, the difference between leaving an estate state and not doing so actually has a big impact on your current consumption, savings, and lifestyle. It will determine the size of your savings needed, which will in turn determine the kind of stress levels you need to go through in your working life.
Well, what do you mean by that? Because if you're assuming you made all the right decisions and you've got a bit of a nest egg, right, and you think that you're not going to spend it all, you hire somebody to write your will for you, or you write your will yourself and you register it, right? What's it got to do with your stress levels?
Well, this is before all that, before you've actually made it, and when you're at the point of deciding about how much money you want to leave behind. Of course, a lot of people don't think about it in those terms, but indirectly, I think that is the implied thoughts that are going through their head. Now, let me give you an example through a case study. Let's say you have achieved your objective of setting up ₱1 million for your retirement at the age of 65. What are the possibilities for you? Let's say you want to find out how much you can consume up to age 90 when investments are made into fixed deposits yielding about 3.5% a year. And let's assume for simplicity at the moment that that's zero inflation. Of course, that is a fantasy world, but just for simplicity, let's assume zero inflation. Now, with an estate of, let's say, 500,000 out of your million, half of your wealth you want to leave as estate, you will be able to spend about ₱4,100 a month. If you don't want to leave an estate, that figure increases to about ₱5,200 a month. It's a difference of about 25%, and 25% is actually quite substantial, especially if the kind of funds that you have at retirement is at the lower end of the figure. So 25% differences in a possible consumption is a big difference. And if I can add one more figure, if you just want to consume only the interest and leaving the entire ₱1 million to the estate, then the amount that you can consume is almost only ₱3,000 a month. So that compares with ₱4,100 with a ₱500,000 estate and ₱5,200 a month with no estate.
So that obviously has a big bearing on your twilight years and how you spend it, because if you choose to not leave any money for your kids and you just want to blow all your money, then you've got a fantastic quality of life.
Well, the message here, Chuang, is not about making value judgments on whether an estate should be established or not. Rather, it's about making you aware of the possible lifestyle differences between the two choices. These lifestyle differences can come in the form of either working much harder today or consuming less in the future, or both. That's what the message of this is trying to say.
So for those investors who are now about to make their initial foray into aggressive assets, right? The first exclusion clause that pops out from the prospectus is the fact that historical returns are not any indication of their future performance. And this investor would be bombarded by all the headlines saying emerging market fallout, volatile days ahead, turbulent periods, and so on and so forth. And he would be reading comments by people like Bill Gross, who would say that this is the new normal, right? Stagnating growth, high prices, etc., etc. So what is one to do? Because this might have been the case in the last 100 years, but the last 100 years are no indication of the next 100 years.
Well, from an investing viewpoint, you have to consider investing from a base case stance, which is that the future is unknowable. But you also have history to back you up in terms of the kind of information that is available out there, in a sense that long-term growth, whether it's GDP or stock market growth, has been positive, right? We've recovered from the crises of, let's say, the Great Depression of the 1930s, the dot-com bust of 2000, the Asian financial crisis, and we have even recovered from the 08 global financial crisis. So if you're making an investing decisions from the viewpoint of how you will handle the unknown, then a very good place to start is your own risk preference. If you want to protect most of your investments, then you will go into some kind of safe investments like bonds. But if you are saying to yourself, okay, I want to take a little bit more risk and I want to be exposed to the kind of growth that is driven by government proactiveness and human innovation, then I would have to take some risk. And even if over the long term, these asset plays don't work out, then you are in a position operating in an environment of deflation. And that would mean that even if sometimes if your asset prices fall, then the deflation would mean that your spending power is still maintained.
Well, I guess to make these complicated calculations, you might actually go to one of the available online financial calculators. There's one at www.financialcalculator.org.
Yep, that's the one I personally like. That's my favorite. And that's all we have for today. Join us next week for the final part of the series of How to Be Your Own Financial Planner, where we'll be talking about buying the right products. Till then, I'm Julian Ng, and I was with
Khoo Soo Chuang,
signing off.
BFM 89.9, The Business Station.